Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in today. Certainly, if you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call. Send us an email. We'll be glad to get your question out there on the air. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, welcome back.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
You have a new puppy.
I do. And, you know, welcome to Sawchuk's home of defective pets. You know, I don't think any of my pets are totally normal. And as everyone knows, I'm very fond of bulldogs. And yep. They are now the number 8 breed in the United States, believe it or not. And we don't probably have them at quite at that level here in this, you know, in this area. But you go to some places like California and Georgia, where Ugga is the you know, team mascot, they're much more prevalent. And this little dog came in to see me in the clinic, actually came in to see cardiology this last week, was diagnosed with a very severe heart disease that is not that uncommon in bulldogs. And it's called pulmonic stenosis. And she's already, poor little thing, in heart failure. And part of the problems with bulldogs is because they have the squished face, they have a lot of respiratory issues. And her nostrils are a little too small to breathe through. And her windpipe or her trachea is too tiny. And as a result, she also has pneumonia on top of this because she can't cough effectively and clear things from her lungs because her airways are too defective. So she's on antibiotics. She's already on some meds to help her little heart. And, you know, I gave her the options were to either euthanize her since there's no surgical. She's not a candidate for surgery. And there is some surgery that can be done on this called a balloon valvoplasty. But hers is too far gone and to be able to be safely done. So I'm giving her a good home, you know, and I think, you know, she's happy and she's not suffering and she's playing. She's got doggy friends already. She's getting enrolled in dog training class. I'm housebreaking her. And believe it or not, the last time I housebroke a dog, I figured it out, it was 1983. That was the last time, because every dog I get, they're all rescue dogs and they're all adults and they're already housebroken. And so this is my first rescue puppy I've had in a long time. So anybody else out there with puppies, you know, you have my sympathy, because being out in the rain and snow is not a lot of fun. But so far, no accidents, and I've had her since Wednesday last week. So.
Oh, good for you. What's her name?
Her name is Matilda. Yes, yes.
That's a perfect name for a bulldog.
It is. You know, I let my daughter name her. She's always wanted to have a puppy that she could name, and she's okay with the fact that we may only have her for a year or so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Every one of our lines is filled. So let's go to the phones, find out what's on people's minds. Marilyn in Milwaukee, we go to you first. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I have a ferret.
Okay.
And a couple of cats, actually. But I'm concerned because he loves milk.
Okay.
And I give it to him, and I'm not sure if it's safe for him. And he also, someone was telling me that they're predators.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking, at first I thought he was just playing with my kitten. But now I'm wondering if he's like
sizing him up.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure.
Right.
And I know one last thing is he's always scratching. I never know if he's got fleas or if he's just got dry skin.
Okay. Well, those are all really good questions. And, you know, I think anytime anyone brings a ferret into their life, they have to, one, ferret-proof their house. And that means that if you have pets such as, you know, guinea pigs, hamsters, birds, anything like that, ferrets will sometimes go after them. That's just kind of their natural tendency. They are a predator. And so if you've got a young kitten that is not able to get up and out of the way, I used to have 5 ferrets, and that was several years ago, and they've all passed away from old age over time, and all of them except one were rescue ferrets. And, you know, so one of them, my daughter convinced me to buy one, and I did, you know. But there's lots of them out there for adoption. In fact, we have a great ferret rescue group right here in the Madison area. It's called the Ferret Nook, and they're just outside of Cambridge, and lots of great ferrets to be adopted. But they are predators, so you do need to make sure that if you do have any small animals and things around the house, that you observe all interactions and make sure that they're in a, not necessarily the ferret, but, you know, your little rodent pets and so on in, you know, a confined cage that's ferret-proofed. regarding the scratching behavior, it's not uncommon. All ferrets will scratch once in a while. But if he's doing it a lot, one thing to be looking into is, yes, they can have some skin conditions. There are, you know, ferrets can pick up fleas and other parasites that our pets can pick up. They're also very prone to ear mites, and that would be something to make sure that you have asked your veterinarian to look into. We see a lot of ferrets with ear mites, so scratching at the head and the ear area may be due to a little parasite that lives in the ear. But we do see them scratching more with a condition that is when their adrenal glands become overactive. And it's quite a common problem in ferrets, and it's usually associated with their hair becoming a little more thin, and they'll get these adrenal gland growths that usually need to be surgically removed. So if your ferret's showing some signs of, you know, hair getting a little thin, especially on the tail, again, this would be something to go in and have your veterinarian have a look at your ferret and see if they can make that diagnosis so it can be treated appropriately.
All right. Okay. And what about the milk?
Oh, the very first question. You know, milk for any pet, you have to be careful, because if they're lactose intolerant, it could cause some problems with their stool. So ferrets tend to have rather loose stool anyways, but if you are seeing that, that it's making the stool loose, or he's drinking milk, overeating his regular ferret diet that you're supposed to be feeding him, then I'd be not giving it to him. A little bit once in a while as a treat, because it's a high protein thing, not a problem. What you need to be really careful about, because ferrets do have a sweet tooth, are all the things like, you know, raisins and anything like that. Remember, one of my ferrets one time got loose and got into a kitchen cabinet, tipped over my daughter's box of Lucky Charms. And I have a photo of her, you know, halfway in the box, eating the marshmallows out of the box. So that shows you what a sweet tooth they have. And so, you know, milk can be a little bit sweet, but just watch. If it causes any loose stool, then stop using it.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Marilyn, for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff in Minocqua, we are on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Sandy.
Hello.
I'm glad to talk to you. On my list of things to do is contact your vet school for information. I have a collie, a wonderful old neutered male collie, and he developed a desiccated, dry, shrinking eye. It came about very abruptly. One day, the eye looked normal. The next day, it began to shrink, and the nictitating membrane wouldn't fully retract over the eye.
Okay.
And I'm told there's a syndrome called collie eye, and we're treating it presently with cyclosporin eye drops. Can you tell me what you can about this? Is there any way to treat it, or is
Yeah. Collie eye anomaly is something that collies are born with, and a good breeder will have their dogs, both the male and the female, checked with a test called a CERF evaluation. I don't mean CERF as in let's go surfing now, but CERF. It stands for Canine Eye Registration Foundation. And this is something that both the parents can be checked for and the offspring. And so buying from a reputable breeder, that would be something that you would want to make sure is that you have a dog in, that you're purchasing a dog that has good eyes. Unfortunately, it is such a common problem in collies. It's uncommon to find a dog with absolutely normal eyes.
And one thing, Sandy.
Yeah.
We didn't buy this collie. This was a dog that someone abandoned, dumped off in northern Wisconsin 10 years ago.
Okay.
Home, and we kept him, and we've had him all these 10 years. So he's 11 years old.
Okay.
And this is just now manifested.
Yeah, yeah. And so he may have been living with collie eye anomaly, which is a whole bunch of conditions that affect the retina and usually result in them being visually impaired, even as puppies. And so it's what I'm concerned more about is there something else that triggered this problem? Because you probably would have seen some eye abnormalities or visual problems earlier in the dog's life. This isn't something that usually just, you know, bang appears when they're older. But sometimes things like some of the fungal infections like blastomycosis can get into the eye and destroy the eye. Sometimes they'll get glaucoma for various reasons, and the eye may then, because of increased pressure, you know, run into troubles with, you know, becoming deceased and, as you said, shrinking and becoming a problem. One other thing to be that I'm concerned about is sometimes we'll see dogs with facial nerve paralysis, actually a nerve problem that affects the muscles of the face, including the muscles and tissues behind the eye. We'll also see another nerve there that is called the sympathetic nerve that can be affected. And when those nerves are affected, we'll sometimes see eyelid drooping, the third eyelid may come up, the eye may sink back into the eye socket. So it looks like the eye's getting smaller, but it's just the fact that it's kind of sunken back. And with the droopy eyelids and so on, it has that appearance of being a smaller eye. So if the eye is still functional, if the pupil still works, then that may be what's going on. And then you're looking down a whole new path. So I hope you've actually had your dog evaluated either by a neurologist or preferably an ophthalmologist to get started with, but it may be that your dog will need to go down the what's going on with the nervous system affecting the eye.
Yeah, I had him into my vet. That would be 10 days ago, and there's no indication that he's got a general nervous system problem on his face. He blinks the eye.
Good.
He reacts to light. He sees through the eye.
Okay.
He examined the eye. That doesn't seem to be the issue. It seems simply that the eye itself is
sunken back.
Yeah. In the eye socket.
And that's what is called Horner's syndrome, and that's what's involved when only the sympathetic nerve is involved. And so there's that sympathetic nerve, it causes a triad of problems. It's called ptosis, meiosis, and enophthalmus. And basically, those words just mean ptosis means a little bit of a droop to the eyelid. They can still blink, but it's just droopy. The eye sinks back in the socket, and sometimes we'll see some changes in the pupil. So your veterinarian, if they look very carefully, they may see some differences in the pupil size from one eye to the other. And if that's the case, then a visit to a veterinary neurologist may be in order. But I'd call the vet school and just see if the ophthalmologist wants to get started looking at this.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Elaine in Richmond, it is your turn next. Let me see if I can find you here. There. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I'm calling about uremic problems in altered cats and female cats.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that? I have a 3-year-old altered female cat,
okay.
And every 3 or 4 months, she has a fit because she can't pee.
Okay.
And she's all over the place, and I know she's peeing some, you know, in the cat box.
Okay.
Eventually.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, permanently, like, obstructed, but is there, like, a medication to keep them from getting into this situation in the first place?
Yeah, you know, when you say uremic, the first that brings to mind, as a veterinarian, a cat that's in kidney failure, and that means that they're
urinating.
Yeah, okay. And so when we have a cat that's maybe straining to urinate, first thing that we need to rule out is the bladder big or is the bladder small? Because if the bladder's big, we'd be worried about there's something obstructing her ability to urinate. By far, that's much more common in male cats because their urethra is smaller in diameter than it is in female cats. So we rarely ever see an obstructed bladder in a female cat, but it can happen. Typically, when we see a female cat that's straining and we palpate their bladder, it's usually small. And then it comes down to what's causing her to have this cyclical change where she's straining to urinate. The two big reasons that we'll see causing this kind of problem, actually three. Number one is a problem where we call it sterile cystitis. I kind of equate it to when we get stressed, we get ulcers. When cats get stressed, their bladder becomes inflamed. And sometimes things like change in your schedule, new cats in the household, anything that can stress her out can bring this kind of thing on. And it usually lasts for, 5 to 7, 8 days, and then they're back to normal again. And so the big things that you can do if that's the diagnosis is push the fluids, lots and lots of fluids. In fact, what we found is to prevent recurrence of this type of problem in cats, just switching, not even changing them to any special diet, but you can say take the same diet that she's currently on and just converting it into an all canned formula.
Yeah.
That can prevent a great number of recurrences. I think it's like we'll prevent like over 50% of the recurrences. I may not have that number right. So that may be something you consider doing. Getting a water fountain for her, kind of de-stressing her by looking at all the different stressors that can happen in her life. And if it's, visitors coming, something like that, try to limit her interactions that may cause her to be a little upset. Also plugging in some feel away, which is that cat pheromone that I've talked about many times on the show, may help keep her from being stressed. And, you know, the other thing you may want to look at medically is having her, when she has one of these episodes, on an anti-inflammatory drug such as meloxicam. It helps decrease the pain that she's experiencing, and so it may help her to not have so much, you know, straining and so on, which is uncomfortable. Other things that we'd be worried about, although it's very uncommon in cats under 10, is a urinary tract infection. Although she may have blood in her urine, if we get a urine sample and culture it, it's very uncommon to get bacteria growing. And it's because cats produce such concentrated urine when they're young that we just don't see bacteria capable of growing in that environment. So it's unlikely, but we probably would want to get a urine sample and rule out whether she's got recurrent urinary tract infections. If we don't grow anything, throwing antibiotics at her is probably just going to stress her out even more, and it's inappropriate use of antibiotics.
Yeah.
Last thing would be a bladder stone that's rattling around in there, causing her to be irritated. And so sometimes getting an x-ray or an ultrasound of her bladder may help. So there's some things to try. Lastly, if you do find out that she does have this sterile cystitis problem, sometimes we can put them on psychoactive drugs to help prevent recurrences, but there's nothing labeled for cat use and they all have side effects. And sometimes just medicating them on a daily basis can be very stressful and add to the problem.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have an email from Lori who has a question regarding what human food items are good or bad for dogs. She says, I've always heard chocolate and, of late, grapes and raisins being
bad. Yeah,
yeah. Is there anything else that absolutely should not be fed to a dog? And she loves when you're on the air.
Perfect. Well, that's a really good question. And for dogs, definitely chocolate. Remember, an ounce of milk chocolate per pound of body weight could be fatal. So, you know, and baking chocolate can be about 10 times the strength of regular milk chocolate. So got to keep that up and out of the way from dogs. Other thing that we'd worry about is grapes and raisins, as the writer said. They can cause kidney failure in dogs. There's enough raisins in a little box of those little snack-sized raisin box to put a dog into kidney failure. So keep them away from the dog. You know, and so I have to be careful. I have birds that like to throw food everywhere. I can't give them grapes or raisins. Or if I do, I have to make sure that the dogs are put away. I clean up the mess before I let them back out into the dining room again where my birds are housed. Other things, macadamia nuts can cause problems for dogs. It's not truly like a fatal toxin, but it can make them pretty sick, and so avoid macadamia nuts. And the other new thing that well, it's actually not that new, but it's still something that people are becoming more aware of since it's being used more frequently, is xylitol. Xylitol is available in a number of human products. It's a sweetener that's a wood-based product from the wood industry, and it's a product from like a wood alcohol, and it tastes sweet to us. It also has some anti-plaque activity, and so as a result, it's being used in a lot of things like chewing gum. And just a pack of chewing gum of, you know, your standard little tiny package of chewing gum, like I leave sometimes on the, you know, in the little console in my car, can put a dog into kidney failure, not kidney failure, liver failure. Oh. But the big thing it does is it causes insulin release and lowers their blood sugar, and they can seizure and die. So gum has to be kept out of the way, and anything with those artificial sweeteners in it, like xylitol, should be kept out of the way of dogs.
Let's go to Marilyn in Montford next. Marilyn, thanks for waiting. Hi to you.
Hello. I have a four or five-year-old Dachshund Golden mix. It was a rescue dog.
Okay. I'm trying to picture that mix in my head. Yeah,
funny looking. Short legs, long body, and beautiful golden hair.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And I took him to the doctor about 10 days ago, and in pain, and he said he has a disc problem.
Okay.
And I was given pain pills, and he was also had chiropractic skills, so he manipulated him, and he started feeling better, but now it's coming back, and I'm wondering what is the expectation for a problem like this.
Well, dachshunds are very, you know, here I live with bulldogs, which are very abnormal. You know, they have a lot of functional problems. Dachshunds, because of their long body, are more prone to having disc issues. In fact, what we find is that a dachshund by 2 years of age, the discs, which are the little cushiony pillows that sit between each of the vertebrae on the back, are aged to the point of like your average 8-year-old dog. Throw into the fact that a lot of them get overweight because they're little dogs, they like to eat, and, you know, they tend to spend their life sitting on the couch, and we, you know, overfeed them and so on, and they don't get enough exercise. You throw that onto the fact that they are jumping up and down, you can really cause some, a lot of stress on that poor, that stress back already. Mm-hmm. And so disc disease, unfortunately, in dachshunds is quite common. So things that you can do would be to make sure that your dog is in great physical shape. Get the weight off of your dog. Anti-inflammatories are going to help. If your dog is not severely neurologically impaired, but just painful, other things you could do would be to look into, you know, just keeping your dog rested. And that means out to go do his business and right back in again on a leash, no stairs. He's carried in and out. It would be no different than putting a person on bed rest. You can't go to work. You can't do any lifting. You're going to be doing the same thing for your dog until they're feeling better. Chiropractic is a great way to help alleviate some of the discomfort as well. But it takes usually multiple adjustments. It's not just one deal. And I'm surprised your veterinarian didn't say come back in a week. Like my chiropractor says to me when I've got some issues to, you know, have another adjustment done. Your veterinarian may also be able to refer you to someone that does acupuncture, which is another way of helping to alleviate pain. Lastly, be looking into if you've got someone in your area that does physical therapy, because we don't want him, if he's going to be resting, to lose his muscle mass, because that's going to lose the support for his back as well. So, you know, maybe looking into a little physical therapy that's going to be safe for a dog that we need to be resting that back. And that a good physical therapist would be able to come up with some exercises to help keep that back nice and strong while not stressing it.
One of the problems is he is very athletic and loves to fly through the air or to jump on a couch or something. And
yeah,
we do walk him 2 miles every day.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the kind of stuff that's going to need to be curtailed at least temporarily or maybe permanently. If he's got on X-ray calcified discs in his back, it may be just a matter of time before he becomes fully paralyzed rather than just painful. Surgery can be done. It's quite expensive. And sometimes even with surgical intervention, if he's got a blown disc that's compressing his spinal cord, he may not return to full function. So you have to be his brains. And, you know, when you get one of these little dogs with their, you know, the long back like Basset Hounds and Dachshunds, 4 on the floor is the rule to live by. And you got to keep him down on the floor and not being allowed up on the furniture. So right now he should probably be in a crate and very limited activity. And if you need to, talk to your veterinarian about maybe a mild sedative or something so he just doesn't care that he's being confined.
Good luck. Thanks, Marilyn, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation as we talk about your pet's health, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Sandy, we have an email from Mark who has three cats, and he really has two questions relating to the three cats. The first relates to his older cat, who's 19, is very traumatic for her, the kitty to go to the vet. The vet did check her about 8 months ago when they adopted their other two cats and found her to be in good health, but he did not run any tests on her. Mm-hmm.
You know, there are house call veterinarians, and for elderly patients, that's a really great way of allowing them to not have to go through the trauma of going in the car. And there many communities have veterinarians that will do house calls. And for, you know, this is a perfect example of when that can be
a good thing
to do. A 19-year-old cat ideally needs to be checked probably at least every 6 months. And I would be strongly recommending, and I recommend this, once cats start to get to be 9 or 10, is getting some baseline lab work done to make sure that we're not dealing with any kidney abnormalities or hyperthyroidism, good physical exam to listen to the heart, weighing the cat to watch for, you know, weight changes, because weight loss can be a big red flag that there's something going on, and sometimes even getting their blood pressure done. So if it's too stressful to drive the cat in, look at a house call.
The other two cats are 8 months old, both in good health, but one is kind of obsessed with food, doesn't eat nonstop, and runs to eat whenever the dish is filled or another cat is eating. She's not obese yet. Our vet said to allow both young cats to eat as much as they want until they're about a year old. Do you agree with that?
I don't. Because most of us are spaying, as veterinarians, spaying and neutering our cats when they're 4, 5, 6 months of age. And once they're altered, that really changes their metabolism. And they have the tendency to put weight on. And if we just let cats eat willy-nilly until that first year, guaranteed they're going to be overweight. And so if they're already spayed and neutered, I would make sure that they're on an adult food. And I would be looking at this point, they probably are close to being their adult size, starting to meal feed them and preferably feeding them separately. And I know it's a little bit of a pain. Dog owners do this all the time when you have a group of dogs. I'm going through it right now, but you can meal feed cats and putting them out a measured amount that's appropriate for their amount of exercise, their metabolism, and what one cat eats. The other cat may eat, you know, much less, and that's what they just feed them as an individual.
Amber in La Crosse has a question for you. Hi, Amber.
Hi. We have a 10-month-old Labrador Retriever who just cannot seem to not eat things that he shouldn't be eating. Anything from, you know, charcoal, rocks, sticks, bugs, anything he can get his mouth around. He's making himself sick on a monthly basis. Our veterinarian told us that when he does get sick from eating things, just not to feed him until his vomiting and, you know, diarrhea goes away. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we can do to prevent him
from wanting to eat? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Some of this may just be training. And so when he's out in the backyard, he should probably always have a human with him.
We only take him out on a leash because of this. And it's just, you know, constant pulling to whatever he can, leaves, you know, anything he can get his mouth around.
Yeah,
Just constant problem.
Yeah, muzzling is a little, you know, you can do that. In fact, I've had some dogs that are chronic, like gravel eaters and so on, and if they're out unattended, they have to have a muzzle on, like a basket muzzle, to prevent them from eating things. But one thing that you may want to look at is if he's pulling on his leash to get to things, have better control of his head. Consider using a head collar, like a gentle leader or a halter.
We have a gentle leader also. We've exhausted pretty much all of our abilities.
Yeah. And then training classes to be able to have a good heel and a good walk so that he's paying attention to you rather than things in the environment. And so if you haven't hooked him up with a good trainer and also training you, because that's what a good trainer is going to do, is train both of you simultaneously, I think that needs to be done. Because when you're out for a walk, he shouldn't be pulling. He should be walking right beside you and happy as can be to be following you. So it sounds like he needs more training and just to be able to be redirected to appropriate things. That way, when he is outside, he's paying attention to you and not, you know, off, you know, trying to, you know, get after things. It's true, when we have a pet that, you know, gets a little upset stomach, you know, calling the vet right away, if it's just like a single episode of vomiting, if there's no blood in it, maybe a little bit of diarrhea, best thing an owner can do is pull them off food, if they're vomiting, even water. And, you know, again, this would be if it's persistent vomiting, obviously seek help. If there's blood in the stool or blood in the vomitus, obviously get help. But, you know, this happens all the time. A little bit of diarrhea, just, you know, diarrhea, hold them off food, diarrhea and vomiting, you may want to food and water. And then gradually start back after, you know, 12, 24 hours, a little bit of water, and then a bland diet like one of the prescription type diets like ID or low residue diet that the IMS company makes, EN that Nestle Purina makes, or a home cooked diet of rice and like boiled chicken or boiled hamburger, just to give the GI tract a good rest because that's so easy to digest. But what I worry about for dogs that are scavengers and eating a lot of things, that eventually he may end up swallowing a rock or something that he's not going to be able to vomit up, and now you've got a problem with an intestinal tract obstruction, and that's where he's heading if he's a 10-month-old dog and he's swallowing things like charcoal briquettes and things like that.
Yeah.
So
good luck.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Carolyn Duluth emailed, has a 100-pound 6-year-old black lab. Last fall, her back legs became paralyzed. Happened very suddenly when she was tearing around the yard. It seemed quite painful to her as well. After great care from our vet, she's almost back to normal. Still tends to drag a back leg occasionally. Never quite understood what happened. The vet told us it had something to do with her spine and that it was a, quote, big dog problem.
Okay.
Quote.
All right.
Could you explain that?
All right. Well, the fact that she was in pain kind of tells me that this may not be what her veterinarian was referring to, but there's a condition that's quite common in large dogs. But we also, once in a while, will see it in small dogs. In fact, we just had a dachshund in at work that had this problem, and it's called an FCE, a fibrocartilaginous emboli. A little bit of the jelly-like disc material gets into the blood supply to the spinal cord and actually causes a small stroke to the spinal cord. Interrupts the blood supply. It happens that quickly. I understand that it's also a problem with things like basketball players who are jumping up and coming down and just, you know, it's like instantaneous, and you get this disc material flying into the blood supply, and the spinal cord becomes immediately non-functional. So that may be what it was. The fact that your dog recovered and your veterinarian is talking about this being the possible problem, because it is more common in large breed dogs. But the fact that your dog was painful makes me think maybe it was like that last caller that had a dachshund with back pain. Maybe it was a slipped disc that bulged and caused some spinal cord compression. That would have been diagnosed by x-rays or an MRI study. And sometimes those will get better with rest, depending on how serious and how much disc material is up into the spinal canal. So it could have been either of those things, but it just goes to show you that with a lot of these neurologic problems, if they haven't lost full function of their back, with appropriate care and rest, they can get better and lead a normal, maybe slightly impaired life.
Janet in West Bend, we're on to you now. Thanks for waiting, Janet. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Can a dog have its spleen removed and still live a normal life?
Definitely. Okay. We see problems with the spleen in humans and dogs and so on. Probably the top two reasons why we'll see problems with the spleen in dogs. One would be trauma if they've been hit by a car. The spleen is one of the organs that helps make some of the blood cells. And by removing it, it just puts more work on the bone marrow to be able to keep up with making red blood cells for the body to be able to use.
Okay, because our dog had a vomiting problem, not keeping food down, and right now he's on some medication that I assume coats his stomach.
Mm-hmm.
I can't read the handwriting.
Okay.
And we had blood tests done, and those were fine, and then x-rays. And in the x-rays, the spleen wasn't really where it was supposed to be.
Okay.
So...
And that tells me that maybe your dog has a stomach twist if it's not where it's supposed to be, or there's something that's making the spleen bigger than normal, so it's shifting in the abdominal cavity.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how old your dog is.
Eight-year-old Doberman.
Yeah, so I get worried about things like, does he have a cancer of his spleen or a hematoma,
when they take a blood test and they test for cancer and blood counts and all that, would that show up in that?
No.
No,
not necessarily.
Okay.
Typically, this would be something that we would see, get inklings of it on an abdominal x-ray, and then we will usually send these dogs to have an ultrasound done so that we can visualize the organs in the body and see if the spleen looks uniformly enlarged or whether there's a mass or something on there as well.
Okay.
So it might be something to talk to your veterinarian about.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And... Dick in Oak Creek, it's your turn. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, hi there. I've got two cat questions for Dr. Sawchuk.
Okay.
Number one, one of our cats, whenever she walks around, her tail is always up in the air.
Yeah.
And I was told, I don't know if this is a myth or an old wives' tale, that means that they're very content and they're in good health.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they're necessarily in good health, but it does mean that they're happy and relaxed. That's a posture that a lot of kittens use when they're, mom's approaching. And so that's how they'll, greet an adult cat is with their tail up. And it's, the anal genital presentation. And so it's kind of like a cat that does the kneading behavior when they're comfortable and relaxed. That's the same type of action that they do when they're nursing on mom. So it's kind of a juvenile behavior, but it means your cat's probably very content and happy.
Okay, and the second thing, what about when the cats purr? When they come up on your lap and they purr, does that mean anything at all?
Well, again, purring is something that We will see cats do when they're dying. We will see cats do this when they're recovering from anesthesia. When they've been, you know, they're in pain, they'll purr. So, you know, don't think that just because your cat's purring that, you know, life is good. You have to look at the whole package. And so if the cat's up on your lap and is, you know, really uncomfortable and losing weight and not eating and so on, just because they're purring doesn't mean that they're happy. So look at all the other things that your cat's doing. But if they're perfectly normal, eating, everything else is fine. You know, that's just a behavior that they do, again, when they're content and relaxed. So,
right.
But you got to look at the whole package.
Thanks, Dick. Thank you for calling. Judy in Fort Atkinson, on to you now. Hi, Judy.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I am a new dog owner, and I have fostered a dog that I now have, and I need to know the right dog food for it.
Well, that's not an easy question to answer because there is no perfect food for every single dog that's out there. And I kind of joke with the students when I'm, you know, when I get this question from them or from an owner, and my you know, kind of flippant response is whoever throws the best party at the convention. Okay, sorry to put it that way, but it's, you know, there really isn't a perfect food. So things that you want to be looking at. Number one would be if the dog has any special medical needs, whether
the dog is a Chinese crested powder puff.
Okay.
Adorable, cute.
Yeah.
Well trained. And it came on Hill's Science Diet Tartar Control.
Okay.
But I have found, I have to get it at the veterinarian I found.
Okay.
So, and that isn't the most convenient thing.
Okay.
And so then I went to a mom's pet store thinking this was going to be a piece of cake.
Uh huh.
They tried to be helpful, but I was thrown off. It's been a long time since I bought pet food, and here they have all bags for breeds.
Yeah,
and I had no idea.
Oh yeah, and it's overwhelming. It really is. It is overwhelming, and almost daily I will have somebody come in. In fact, I just had somebody today that said, "Yeah, I'm feeding." And they named a brand, and I was like, I've never even heard of that one before. And so, and I'm pretty up on most of the pet foods that are out there. So lots of new ones coming out. Big things, like if the dog was on a tartar control diet, and I assume you're talking about one called TD.
Yeah, totally, because he's only 4 years old.
Yeah.
He had his teeth cleaned a year ago.
Yeah.
And the vet recommended that then.
And if he had his teeth cleaned already as a 3-year-old and he's only 4, he's probably your typical Chinese crested. They tend to have more dental problems, and it's because of the way the teeth are kind of configured in their mouth. And so you know, I think even though it's inconvenient to have to go to the veterinarian to buy this particular diet, from the standpoint of saving him needing to have dentistry done again in the future, might not be a bad idea to stay with it. It's large chunks. They look like the size of a charcoal briquette, and they're designed to have a fiber matrix in the middle that doesn't shatter when they bite into it. So it kind of encases the tooth when they chew on it, and it squeegees the plaque off the teeth and prevents it from becoming into tartar. So that might be something to be looking at. If you want to switch to another diet and you want to stay in the science diet line, I don't mean to be naming brands here, but they do have an oral care that's available over the counter that's very similar, and you may find that you'll get the same benefit. Mm. But if you switch to something else, things to be watching for, although he probably doesn't have a whole lot of hair. You know, he's just got is he a powder puff that, meaning just...
He's got a lot of hair.
He does have a lot of hair. Mm-hmm. See, Chinese crested, typically, there's kind of two versions. The hairless one with just a little bit of hair in their head, and then she said, I forgot, powder puff, which is the hairy version of the Chinese crested. So it's the hairy...
Hairy
bald dog. Yes. So watch hair coat to make sure that it's staying nice and glossy. Look at his stool volume and quality. Things like flatulence level, since he's living with you. I mean, there's some dogs that just that can't tolerate certain foods. And stay with one that is for his age group, too. So if senior, it doesn't sound like he's a senior, he's a 4-year-old dog. So regular adult dog food, if he's prone to being a little overweight, going with one that's in the light category would be a good idea as well.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy, and if you have a question for her, I hope you'll join us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1422. 1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Jean in Beaver Dam's up next, so let's go to Jean. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a 2-year-old female cat, and she's losing her fur on her belly and kind of on the sides.
Mm-hmm.
Just over the last couple months, and I was wondering if it's her health is not good. I mean, she seems healthy otherwise.
Do you see her grooming?
Yeah.
Okay, so you watch her, and is she actually pulling the hair out?
I have seen her pull her hair out.
Okay. I'd really be worried. There's two reasons why cats will barber their hair on their belly like that, and sometimes it can even be on the legs and things. Number one reason would be something that's making her itchy. And it's like, oh, it's a no-brainer. Why am I here? You know, she's already, you know, she's pulling her hair out. But, the trouble is trying to find what's making her itchy.
Uh-huh.
Whether it's, there's a mite that we're seeing more commonly in cats, a Demodex mite that lives in the hair follicle. They look like a little cigar when we look at them under the microscope. And they're quite contagious, and that could be making her itchy. Sometimes flea allergy dermatitis can present that way as well. So if she's an indoor-outdoor cat and maybe getting the odd flea exposure, not enough to infest your home, but enough to be bitten and be irritated, she could be bit on the tip of her tail and still be wanting to groom her belly because the flea saliva will get into her system and trigger a whole body response. Other things that would be, you know, things we would look at would be environmental allergens or like house dust mites, pollen, molds, that kind of thing, or perhaps a dietary problem with food allergies where it's an ingredient that she may not be tolerating.
Okay.
That would be a good reason to go to the veterinarian and have her skin looked at to make sure that there's no underlying infections or anything else there that could be making her itch. The reason why we have to rule that out is the other condition that we see, which is called psychogenic alopecia, which just means that she's barbering her hair coat because she's stressed or anxious. I kind of equate that to a person biting their fingernails to the quick. It's just something, it's a habit that she gets into as a way of dealing with her stress. And those cats usually are closet groomers. Owners don't see it being done. They do it when they're left alone. The fact that you're seeing her actually licking and pulling her hair out tells me that it's probably the former, some medical reason. So back to the veterinarian to have that looked into.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Jim in Spooner, your turn now. Hi, Jim.
Good morning.
Morning.
Afternoon. Morning, I guess.
Morning, yeah. Still morning.
Just a quick question on the use of ibuprofen. I hear some people say don't give it to them. Some people say do. I'm talking about field dogs after running out Dakota's pheasants for 2-3 days in a row.
Yeah.
They kind of get gimped up. They get sore. Their pads get tired.
Yeah.
Aspirin, ibuprofen, any do's, don'ts?
The big problem with ibuprofen for dogs is that the therapeutic dose is very, very close to the toxic dose. And so if you wanted to use a drug that is in the same kind of family as ibuprofen, I would recommend talking to your veterinarian about getting a prescription for a drug called carprofen or Rimadyl. That drug is much safer for dogs than ibuprofen. And this is the problem with just grabbing human drugs is that, you know, things like Tylenol, which we find very safe, can be very, very toxic for dogs and cats. Even aspirin at, you know, what we would think as is normal doses can cause gastric ulcers and problems for dogs. And so I typically stay away from the human products and like to go with ones that are actually been shown to be safer for dog use. And there's multiple ones out on the market. There's one called Daracoxib, Meloxicam, the one I just mentioned, Carprofen.
I've heard of Rimadyl.
Yeah, but these are all prescription drugs that you would get from your veterinarian. And again, even with, you know, intermittent use, they're usually very safe. If your dog needs to be on them long term, we like to do a little bit of blood work before, a little bit of blood work afterwards to make sure that their body's tolerating the medication.
All righty. Thank you much.
You're welcome.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Ron in Abrams. Ron, hi to you.
Good morning. I've heard a couple of your programs lately talking about leashes and collars for dogs and so on and so forth.
Uh-huh.
When I took our dog for training when she was a pup, she pulled a lot, and the trainer suggested I go to a pinch collar.
Okay.
This worked very well. I mean, immediately she was a good dog.
Yeah.
And I've recommended this to other people, and the same results. especially these big dogs that pull people down the road.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've not heard anybody mention this pinch collar thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're a little controversial, and the phrase that I like to bring up when people bring it in is the dog listening to the jerk at the end of the leash, or the jerk at the end of the leash. Sorry. you know, if you're making the dog walk and be nice because of pain, how pleasant is that for the dog? Yes, you're training them, but you're using kind of harsh principles. And so there's still people that will use that, but make sure that it's being used appropriately, that it's fitted appropriately, that you're working with someone that's well-versed in using a pinch collar. I never recommend using them in puppies. I feel that for puppies, training needs to be fun. It needs to be pleasant. They need to want to do what you're asking them to do. And the only way you're going to have that happen reliably is, you know, having a dog that is, you know, likes doing it, and it's pleasant. And so using other training devices, one of my favorite things right now is a harness type device that does up at the front of the dog. It's not a head collar. It's not a harness that does up over the back, which just causes the dogs to pull. But there's one that's called the Sensation. There's an Easy Walker harness. There's a couple of different models out there. And for real chronic pullers, that's been found to be very successful. And it doesn't induce pain for the dog. So to show whether your dog is truly trained to be able to walk, I'd say take the pinch collar off and put a regular collar on and see if your dog works well without it. Because if it's only responding because of the pain, it's controversial. So that's why we don't bring it up.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Ron. Shirley and Prentice, we're on to you now. Hi, Shirley.
Thank you, Larry. I don't have need for a basket muzzle for my dog, but I'm curious if a dog wears that, and I live in the woods. Would it get caught in the woods? And then I have another quick question.
Yeah, you have to be very careful. Muzzles, I mean, there's two kinds of muzzles that are available for use. One of them is the ones that veterinarians use, which are just the little nose cone that covers up the mouth so that the dog can't open their mouth and bite us when we're working with them. Those are meant to be used temporarily. Dogs can't pant with those on, or they can pant minimally. They can't take water. So those are just on and off very quickly to be able to get a job done if you've got a dog that likes to use their teeth. The other type of muzzle you typically will see on working dogs, like police dogs and so on, just to be able to keep them safe in situations where they don't need to have their mouth exposed. And again, they are never left on unattended. Those are usually muzzles that are put on when a human's around, so that in case they do get into trouble, like getting caught on something, you can take them off. But again, just one of those safety measures that we can use, but any of those devices shouldn't be left on unattended.
I see. Now, my other question was about TD dog food for dogs, and I do use that along with other food, but I'm wondering if the large size TD is good for an 18 healthy 11-year-old 18-pound, I mean.
Yeah. Well,
a Karen Terrier.
Yeah, I used to feed my Yorkie, who weighed 7 pounds, the large dog TD. I would count out 7 pieces a day, and that's what she would get. It took her all day to eat it, but it kept her teeth clean. And they do make a smaller version for little dogs, but it just depends on the dog's chewing capability. And so you can try it, definitely. And most vets will give you a little sample of it to see if your dog is able to chew it comfortably. And remember, we're talking about these diets, but if you've got a dog with dental disease, you don't want to be introducing one of these diets because it's going to hurt the dog to chew on them. So first things would be eliminate the diseased teeth, help, you know, treat the get the tartar off the teeth, you know, treat the gum disease, get everything taken care of. And then once the mouth is healed, this is something that can be used as a preventive device to prevent plaque and tartar buildup on the teeth. So
he's been eating this for years, but along with another dog food too. Mm-hmm. But I will, and he handles the big ones very
good,
well.
Good.
But I think it's a good. I guess I will take him in and have his teeth looked at. They look perfect to me and his
good.
Gums,
and that should be part of your annual exam: is flip that lip and have a look, not just at the front teeth, but all the way back at the those back molars as well, because that's where we see a lot of disease.
Right. Thank you very much.
You're
all
welcome.
Right.
Thank you for calling. And Doug in Eau Claire, question from you. Hi.
Hi. I have a 4.5-5-year-old Sharpei German Shepherd mix, and she's a wonderful dog. I've had her to the vet, and she is in perfect health, great muscle tone, but it's averaging about every 6 months, about since a year and a half ago, she's had what I would call a seizure.
Okay.
And I guess all I can really do is when she does these is just I make sure that she's on the ground and just comfort her, but I want to make sure that this, it seems to be happening every 6 months,
okay.
Roughly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because she doesn't have to drive a car or hold a job, infrequent seizures like that, if medical reasons have been ruled out, if she's been looked at, her blood sugar's normal, liver values are normal, electrolytes are normal, they can't find any other reason for her to be having these things, you may want to just say, well, you know, let's just watch and see what happens and keep a seizure diary. I usually say if dogs are having more than 6 to 12 seizures per year, or if they're coming in clusters, meaning two or three in a day, or they're lasting longer than just a couple of minutes, then we may want to institute medical management using phenobarbital or potassium bromide or other combinations of drugs to be able to have her lead a normal life. But you're doing the right thing. Remember, they won't swallow their tongue. But just keep her safe. Keep her on the floor. Don't let her be near stairs or sharp things. And let her ride through the seizure. And, you know, if it was my patient, I probably would not be recommending treatment if they were every 6 months.
Doug, thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening in. And many callers online and some emails in front of us, so we'll go right back to business here and on to Darren in Hartford. Darren, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for having your show. My question is, my dog gets diarrhea once in a while, and I give her like a half a dose, not even, of Pepto-Bismol, and it seems to help her, and I just want to make sure that it is, and I'm not harming her.
Yeah, you're probably not harming her at all. Question is, why is she getting recurrent diarrhea? You know, hopefully she's been looked at for intestinal parasites, and you know that you're not, she's not getting into things that she shouldn't, getting into the trash, you know, human food that may be bothering her intestinal tract. So having, you know, routine parasite exam done, having a good physical exam done by your veterinarian. If they can't find any reason for it, and, you know, she's healthy in all other regards, yeah, sure, a little bit of Pepto-Bismol or something like that won't be a problem. Cat owners need to be really careful because Pepto-Bismol has salicylates in it, which is like in the aspirin category. And if they're using that in cats, you have to be really careful because they don't metabolize those very well and can become toxic.
Yeah, I think she gets into our compost every once in a while.
Oh, yeah, and that can be a problem, and you may want to consider having that compost bin protected, you know, a little fence or something around it, because fermenting things like that can, you know, sometimes really get the dog's tummy upset. So try to keep her out of that if you can.
Thank you very much for calling, Darren. And let's go to Sherry in West Bend. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I have a question for Sandy about little dogs. I have two dachshunds, and my understanding was you shouldn't really take them for long walks, like a 2-mile walk, because that's hard on their backs.
I think that is really bad advice because they can walk. I mean, they were bred to be little hunting dogs.
Yeah.
And, you know, walking is a great way to give them the exercise without stressing their back.
Mm-hmm.
Stressing their back is going to be jumping up and down. So walking keeps their legs strengthened, helps support their muscle mass, burns calories. So whoever gave you that advice gave you bad advice. Okay. All right. All right.
I still take mine for pretty long walks.
Good, good.
The young one, the 2-year-old, they're both mini dachshunds. And now she has such problems with her feet bleeding. And whether I don't take them out when there's salt, of course. You know, we go on a trail. We did do a two-mile walk, and she suffered for days with sores on her feet.
Oh, my goodness.
And I've tried everything. I mean, I don't know what to do anymore. We can't keep little doggy boots on her. And
yeah, yeah. They do make, there's a salve that you can use for feet for dogs that have sensitivity, especially to salt and snow. Mushers use it, people that do sled dogging.
Okay.
And I think it's called Mushers Secret. If you go online, you can look up, you know, something like that. And some pet stores will carry it.
Okay.
And that may help. But the question is, why is her feet bleeding? Why are her feet bleeding? You know, and does she have a, you know, chronic foot infection? Does she have some type of an immune problem affecting her feet? Does she have allergies with, you know, yeast infections that are making her feet more irritated? If you haven't brought this up with your veterinarian, I think it's a good idea to have that looked into, because that's not normal. And
I thought maybe her little pads just were they're pretty soft yet.
Yeah, but they should be able to, you know, take a normal length walk. Yeah.
Yeah. I just went online and Mushers Secret. You can I see it all over the place.
Oh, yeah. It's readily available. Yeah.
Okay. So if they lick that?
It's perfectly safe. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a nice, safe thing to use on dogs' feet.
All right. We'll give that a try next time she sees the vet. I will have them check out her feet.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Sherry. And Rose in Menominee Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. I'm very anxious to talk to you. I have a very sick cat who they think it's fatty liver syndrome.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And he did manage to get a feeding tube inserted.
Okay.
And I've had him home now for several days, and I'm tube feeding him, and he's got all kinds of medications, and one day he seemed to be a little more alert, and the last couple of days he's been very lethargic and has not made it to his cat box. And
oh my!
And I'm seeing my vet regularly. I saw him yesterday.
Okay.
But is there a prognosis? Is there a
Yeah.
What should I look for?
Well, let me just back up and just for the listeners that don't know what fatty liver syndrome is in cats. Cats being carnivores, they have a need for lots of protein, and their liver does not handle a big load of fat going to it at one time. And so whenever we have a cat that goes off its feeding and normal eating, so a cat that's stressed, a cat that's sick for some reason, you know, for whatever reason, they start metabolizing their body fat as a source of energy, and all this fat ends up kind of getting clogged up in the liver. This type of problem can have a high fatality rate. It does require a lot of intensive care treatment. Most of these cases that we see are put in intensive care so they can be monitored and, you know, lab work rechecked and so on. And it sounds like your cat, if he's that ill, that he's that weak, probably should not be treated at home and probably needs to be, you know, in a facility where he can be monitored around the clock, and, you know, making sure that his blood sugar level is normal, that his potassium level is normal. Those would be all things that need to be monitored frequently with these kitties, because they're not eating, they're not getting the electrolytes they need, they may not be getting the, you know, the energy that they need, and will, you know, those things can cause weakness. And then, the question is what triggered him to have fatty liver to begin with. And it's uncommon to have it just be fatty liver. A lot of these kitties also have associated with the fatty liver pancreatitis. They may have some type of inflammatory bowel disease as well. And those would be all things that need to be evaluated. And I don't know if an ultrasound was done on your cat's belly, but that might be helpful to be able to look at some of the other organs that besides the liver to make sure that this is truly just fatty liver disease. And maybe even consider, you know, getting a liver biopsy done to confirm this, because if he's got something like a bacterial infection in his liver that could be, you know, looking like fatty liver syndrome, you know, he needs to be on the appropriate antibiotics. So these are expensive cases to treat. About 40% of them die. But that doesn't mean that your cat can't be in that 60%. So even though you were at your vet yesterday, time to go back. And it may even mean a referral to a specialist.
Good luck.
Okay. Thank you.
You're
thank
welcome.
You very much for calling. We had an email from Susan, who has a yellow lab female, wonders what is the most optimum, safe, or best age to spay her yellow lab. I've listened to many interesting debates about that. 3 months, some say 8 months, some say after the first heat. And then also, when might we expect a first heat?
Well, the first heat's really variable, and I would kind of look at family history a little bit. Sometimes they can occur as young as 6, 7, 8 months of age. Other times it's after they're a year of age. So there's a lot of variability that way. There is nothing cast in stone as to when is the best age to spay an animal. I can tell you that the more heat cycles they have, the greater the chance of them developing breast cancer down the road.
Oh.
So spaying them prior to having a heat cycle will help eliminate the chances of her developing breast cancer. Virtually, it's almost non-existent in dogs spayed at puberty. Then it comes down to, well, what age do you do it? Well, I like to do it after they've finished with their vaccines and before they have a heat cycle. So that usually means sometime between 4 to 6 months of age. The younger you do it, and what we found when there was a big push for early age spay-neuter programs where shelters were doing it at 8, 9, 10 weeks of age, even 12 weeks of age, that a lot of these dogs ended up having problems with urinary incontinence where they would start leaking urine when they lay down. It can be managed medically, but it's a little bit of a pain because now you've got to deal with drugs every day or so on. There's a couple of different protocols we can use. So by waiting until they're over 4 months of age, you may still have that, but it's not at the same rate as you would have if you do it as an early age spay-neuter. So get the vaccines done, and then it's up to you and your veterinarian between 4 and 6 months of age, which would hopefully catch her before she has a heat cycle. And you want to do it at a time when she's not in heavy duty into training, when you've got a little break, because obviously with the sutures, she can't be romping with other dogs.
Karen in Wauwatosa, on to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a dog that's 3 years old, and I got her from the Humane Society. She was very nervous, and she's gotten used to the home, where I live right now, and she's pretty good, but now I'm moving, and she's extremely nervous over there.
Okay.
I don't know what to do with her.
Yeah.
She has like a startle reflex if something falls.
Yeah, yeah. Few things to think about. Number one, when you do, you know, bring her into your new environment, try to have some familiar things there. So the house kind of smells like, you know, her home. If she's got a spot that in your house where you currently live, that's kind of her safe zone, whether it's her crate or under a coffee table or wherever it may be, make sure that that's available for her. Think about plugging in a DAP diffuser. I mentioned earlier in the show a product called Feel Away for cats, which is facial pheromone. A DAP diffuser is another form of pheromone therapy, but it's a dog pheromone. Has no effect on people, no effect on cats, but it does make dogs feel calmer in a natural way. And that may help the introduction to the new home go a little bit smoother. Try to, if you can, take her over there in for just brief visits and have her be doing something fun. And if her favorite thing is playing tennis ball, maybe play a little ball with her and then go home, rather than be unpacking boxes and making a lot of ruckus. She likes to eat, feed her her favorite treats while she's sitting and staying and in a relaxed body posture. Then go home. So you're just kind of gradually introducing it while she's feeling comfortable and relaxed, rather than just throwing her into this new environment and having her be stressed out again.
So, is there anything, if that doesn't help much, is there anything else that...
Well, sometimes we need to resort to using psychoactive drugs, and I would have to leave that up to your veterinarian as to whether she is a good candidate for that. But there are drugs that we can use to relieve some of the dog's anxiety. Some of them need to be on board for 2 to 4 weeks before they start reaching therapeutic levels. Some of them work a little bit faster. But remember, whenever we're using some of these drugs, some of them can be sedating, and it's actually going to slow down the learning process too. So although it may alleviate some of her anxiety, it's going to take her longer to be a little more comfortable in the home. So I try to avoid drugs if I can.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Karen. Mary in Pierport, Michigan. On to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a sister in Georgia who has a hobby farm and lots of animals. And in the house, she has several cats and dogs. And the one of the dogs, a Shar Pei, real sweet doggy, will not keep himself keep his nose out of the cat box. And he, so he goes in there, does, you know, I don't know what he's trying, why he wants to eat whatever is in there, but
because he's a dog. Yeah.
And he, if he doesn't get caught right away, he spreads it all over the place. So,
I used to have basset hounds that would do that, and there was nothing worse than climbing into bed at night and finding kitty litter on your pillow, and you knew exactly what they did. They went into the box, they got one of what I call a kitty fritter, and brought it up and enjoyed it while laying in the sunshine on my bed. Dogs are dogs, and fecal material to dogs, especially cat fecal material, because remember, they're carnivores, have a lot of nitrogenous waste in their stool, which makes it stinky, but for dog's point of view, that makes it more appealing. So things that you can do. Number one, make sure the cats have access to the litter box, but the dog doesn't. So putting up baby gates that the cat can get under or jump over, and that sometimes helps. Covered boxes will probably not keep the dog out, but may keep the cat out, because a lot of cats don't like covered boxes. And keep the box clean. That's the number one thing. She's got to be in there scooping at least a couple of times a day, so you decrease the chance of the dog being able to find it. So, that's really about all you can do in this situation. It's pretty normal dog behavior, but very disgusting. And make sure she's brushing your dog's teeth, because it's one of the leading causes of dental problems is packing all that fecal material. This always comes up at lunchtime, doesn't it? On the teeth. So hopefully that'll solve your sister's problem.
Thanks, Mary. Thank you very much for calling. Ellen in Bailey's Harbor, your turn.
Hi. I have a corgi that was delivered to me, and it was clear that this woman was not going to take her home again, and I've had her for 2 years. And I was told by somebody that a sure sign of hip problems is when a dog runs, he runs with his hind legs together. They kind of run in cadence. And she does that. And I'm wondering if corgis are prone to that or if their spines are in the same...
Yeah, interesting you brought it up, because even though corgis are a small breed of dog, they are a breed that we do see problems with hips in. And I don't know what the percentage is, but it is something that we can run into troubles with. And they do get hip dysplasia, which is laxity in the hip joints that results in arthritis. And breeders, good breeders of corgis are going to have their breeding stock evaluated for hip dysplasia before they put them into the breeding program. So if you're concerned about your dog's hips, getting an x-ray done would probably be of some benefit. The reason is, although we probably don't have anything that we can do, treatment-wise surgically at this point, except for removing the ball part of the ball and socket hip if it's that severe. Sometimes there is a surgery that can be done that way in small dogs. You may be able to start using things like joint diets, joint supplements like glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate, fatty acid supplements, changing the way you exercise your dog to help keep the muscle strength but not aggravate the joints. Lots of different things that we can do, including acupuncture, physical therapy. So, get a diagnosis and make sure that that's really what's going on.
All right.
Okay. I have one more question, too. Is that okay? She does not get along with other animals, and that's the reason why I have her.
Okay.
I don't have any other animals, and she's 6 years old, and everything I have done to try and change that behavior has not worked.
Mm-hmm.
She just gets gnarly and bares her teeth at anybody, any animal that gets too close to her. She took a hunk of fur out of a cat's side.
Oh, my goodness.
She's really nasty.
Okay. But she obviously gets along well with people because you
Absolutely.
Have her. Yeah. And that a lot of that is early training and what she was exposed to and the amount of socialization that she got. Just having her multiple times exposed to a situation where she's upset is probably not going to be doing any good. Working with a trainer, or I should say an applied animal behaviorist that has a therapy dog, a dog that's not going to react to any outburst from her, who can help you with desensitizing her to the presence of other dogs. And this can be a pretty complicated behavior modification program. So trying it on your own really may not be that successful. And that's probably what you've been doing. So, you know, looking into getting some help from a behaviorist, the chance of turning her around and having her be a super friendly, outgoing dog that you can take to dog parks and out in public, probably non-existent, but you may be able to make, you know, her life a little bit better. Maybe she can have the odd doggy friend or two. But, you know, I live with a female dog that's like that as well, and a male that they get along fine with each other, but there's just certain dogs that they don't like. And, you know, and I just kind of adjust my life to that because I know that, part of it's because I'm lazy and I have a fenced yard and a lifestyle that allows that. But, you know, so much of it is based on what her previous life was like, and you may not be able to turn back the hands of time.
No.
Thank you very much for that dire information.
Okay.
Well, good for you for taking care of that dog, though.
I know. It's wonderful. And, you know, and it's, you know, seeing a dog like this that maybe wouldn't have a home, to have a home with somebody that understands it and may be able to adjust her environment to, you know, provide this dog a good space where it can be comfortable and happy.
Thanks again, Ellen. Appreciate your call. Val has a question, emailed a question about her 11-year-old neutered shepherd mix. Has some arthritis, mostly in the forelegs, possibly neck. He's on Prevacox and doing pretty well, but lately he's been defecating in the house. Seems he just can't quite hold it.
Okay. Oh, you know, I worry about, is this dog now incontinent?
He doesn't urinate in the house.
Yeah, though. And so the fact that he is only defecating in the house and it just feels that he can't hold it, questions I'd be asking is, where is it happening? Is it happening in his bed? Is it happening as he's walking across the floor and he coughs and out comes some fecal material? Then I'd be thinking this could be a neurologic problem. And the fact that he's got some neck issues may be part of this, and he could have multiple spinal cord problems going on simultaneously. So having him reevaluated for other spinal cord problems may be necessary. And while he's in for that, they may be able to check to see if he has proper anal tone. And it may be just a matter of either diapering him, if that's the case, or providing him with a spot that if he does have an accident, it's not going to break your heart, like it's not on a carpet or something like that. So keeping him in more of a confined area. We do sometimes see as dogs get older cognitive decline and they just kind of forget, but it's rarely just stool. It's usually stool and urine, and there's other things going on as well, such as him, you know, forgetting who you are and getting lost in the house and, you know, all the different kind of senility type changes that we see. So I doubt that that's what's going on, but that should be something else that be questioned quite carefully.
Jennifer in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Jen.
Hi. I've got a golden retriever mixed dog here, about 13 years old, whose nails have been neglected for far too long. What does one do to get that remedied? It seems this dog is in pain with it.
Yeah, the quicks will grow out, and then you end up having these very, very long nails. You can only trim off so much before you make them bleed, and it's uncomfortable for the dog. What I like to see done is have the nails trimmed professionally, and then someone can show you how to keep them filed using like a Dremel tool. They do have that new, I think it's called a Petit Paw. It's a battery-operated grinder for nails.
Yeah.
My little mini consumer reports, I shouldn't use their name, but my little consumer test at the clinic found that not very good for big nails and very poor power. As soon as you put a little pressure, it stops the motor. So for little tiny dogs, not bad, but bigger dogs, don't save your money and invest in one of like the power grinders that you would find in like a hardware store. Using a sandpaper disc on that would be very helpful. And it's just a matter of keeping them trimmed. And as they stay short, you know, you keep them nice and short, that quick will recede a little bit and those nails will get shorter.
And thank you very much for calling. And Sandy, thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
Time flew by again. You'll be back on April 14th.
I think so.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. Really pleased to have her along. She'll be back April 14th, and we'll go through this again. Sorry we didn't get to everyone. Just to let you know, coming up tomorrow, Tom Evans of the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey and Professor Bill Cordua of UW River Falls talk with us about asteroid craters found in Wisconsin. And then we'll take a look at sheep and wool with Ray Antonovich of the AZ Farm at Oregon, Wisconsin, and Elaine Hendrickson, owner of Coed Mar Woolen Mill at Cabria, Wisconsin. So that's coming up tomorrow on the program.